Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast. I'm Trent Kling. He's Leighton Kling. Coming up on today's show, a bevy of earnings calls, but really an eye inside pandemic buying conditions. And we're really looking forward to going over some of this information that we've found with you. Also, bad news from Tuesday morning. Maybe not bad news, but expected news as they declare Chapter 11 bankruptcy this last week. Sadly, no interview this week. Our interview guest had to reschedule to next week because of some goings on in their particular area. So we'll have an interview next week that we're really looking forward to, talking about the state of the consumer at this point in 2020. A reminder quickly before we get to the news to like us and rate us however you access us, whether that be on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher, any other podcast listening service. You can also check us out on social media at Retail Podcast on both Instagram and Twitter. So we lead today's show with Dollar General, as Dollar General gives us some insight as to their pandemic sales trends this week. The company held their annual meeting of shareholders on Wednesday the 27th before revealing their first quarter earnings on Thursday the 28th. Before we start, by the way, just mind-boggling, and I kind of forget about this until their annual meeting of shareholders, but despite the massive store count for Dollar General, no stores in Wyoming, Montana, Idaho, or Washington, only 11 in Utah. So we talk about their growth patterns, definitely some white space in some rural areas in the upper Mountain West. But let's talk about those earnings first, as Zacks consensus estimates had them pegged for earnings of $1.68 per share, which would have been up from $1.48 per share a year ago.
And Trent, we knew sales numbers were going to be way up for Dollar General, but their numbers far exceeded our initial expectations. Same-store sales increased a crazy 21.7% for the quarter ending May 1st. So this basically includes 6-8 weeks of pandemic-related buying patterns. So all of that pandemic buying really paying off for Dollar General in a number of categories. 21.7% of an increase destroyed our guesses, of course, which topped out at mid-teen increases. So too were most analyst estimates crushed. For comparison, Family Dollar, whose parent company, Dollar Tree, released earnings on the same day, same-store sales increases of 15.5% there. And you look, Trent, everyone pretty much in this space has been doing very well as of late. Dollar Tree ended the quarter down 0.9% in comps, however, suggesting their late April was just awful after their initial COVID sales update in mid-April. For Dollar General here, same-store sales were up 5.5% in February before pandemic buying conditions really hitting in most of their locations. Net sales came in at 27.6% over last year, due in large part to the same-store sales increases, but also, to Trent's point, their ever-growing footprint, which has added nearly 1,000 locations in the past year. So just astounding growth from Dollar General. On the earnings front too, Dollar General's diluted earnings per share front came in at $2.56, a full 88 cents or 52% over analyst estimates. So again, $2.56 per share in diluted earnings per share. This number was actually 73% higher than last year, by the way. As a result, cash flow was way, way up. Cash flows from operations increased 202% over last year. These are numbers that we don't often look at when we cover an earnings call or earnings guidance or anything of that nature. Dollar General is just killing it on all fronts. They did note that there were some increased expenditures in hiring, which is to be expected. They have more stores and they have more of a need for staff at already mature stores. Their hiring rate has doubled there since mid-March, which is, again, just a crazy amount of hiring that is needed. But right now, Trent, there's no lack of supply for potential Dollar General workers either. So it's kind of a good time to hire if you were in the need of employees. Additionally, they noted $60 million towards bonuses, benefits, and employee resources. Unlike other retailers, they didn't really see an erosion in margins as a result of pandemic buying conditions or store safety initiatives. This was due in large part to a lack of markdowns and higher initial prices on certain products they're bringing in through their supply chain. What opened our eyes was the extent to which certain categories saw growth for them. And Trent, it is very interesting because we knew consumables would be way up, but their largest percent increase, I'll just let you say it.
It was home products. And that's kind of a unique thing because we knew consumables, as you mentioned, would be up year over year, but home products going up for them. This kind of dovetails with something we'll talk about later on in the podcast with Big Lots, because we're seeing now the impacts from the stimulus checks trickle on through to retailers, and we're seeing some categories that are up over last year that might not have been up without those stimulus checks. They also saw same-store sales increases in seasonal as well, and seasonal is something we wondered about before Easter hit. How would the Easter sales go? Would there be significant markdowns surrounding Easter? Again, that was kind of the heart of the stay-at-home orders, where Easter happened this past year. But again, positive for the quarter as a whole when it comes to seasonal for Dollar General. They didn't really sprinkle a lot of color into that, whether that meant Easter sales were up or whether some of their summer seasonal sales are now up. But something to note, at least for them. And they were one of the only retailers to see a same-store sales increase in apparel. Now, it's not often that we're correct, but we started looking at this about 2 months ago, that Dollar General's position as one of the only retailers who are able to stay open might bode well for their apparel categories. But again, to see an increase here, so we're not just talking about, oh, well, it did better than expected. It was an increase year over year. That indicates that people were still spending money on apparel, but they were just changing the places in which they were doing so. Now, granted, it is worth noting that Dollar General was working from a pretty low position in terms of apparel sales, so a lower bar to clear. But still, you look at a lot of rural areas in which Dollar Generals are situated, again, it's them and the grocery store, the only games in town, and the only stores that were really open during the pandemic in many areas. So if in mid-April you needed a new dress for your daughter, let's say, Dollar General in those areas was really the only place to get it, because a lot of people don't really understand this when they talk about e-commerce and the like, but sometimes shipments to rural areas are late in arriving, and if you needed something on a quick turnaround, say quicker than a week, Dollar General might have been your main option. Amazon in particular, I live in Colorado, and I've had to wait 2 to 3 weeks on some Amazon shipments. Clothing, not a high priority right now for Amazon, so I can only imagine if you lived in a town of 500 to 600 people, you've got a Dollar General and a supermarket, you're going to opt for those options there for apparel over maybe waiting a week or two when you just can't do that for that particular clothing item. Now, I wanted to talk briefly about the meeting of shareholders. One of the notes that we found interesting during the meeting was actually regarding their store footprints. And this is something Leighton and I talked about off the air this week, because we've heard in the past from non-Dollar General sources, but from people surrounding the organization, from landlords and the like, that Dollar General would prefer to push certain locations beyond the 9,000 square foot mark. So you look, some of their older locations are around 7,900 square feet. They have some locations that are as low as maybe 6,000 square feet. But they indicated during this meeting that that wasn't necessarily the case. They lauded their multiple store formats as a way of being flexible on a market-by-market basis, and they feel like they've built flexible layouts, flexible planograms that can accommodate various square footages. And this is something that we've wondered in the past, if whether relocating for the sake of expanding their square footprint was something they would pursue for smaller locations, especially some of the previous generation locations. Again, those locations that were built in the 90s that might have been built before their larger press into Fresh Foods, which Leighton will talk about here in a second. However, they are confident in the sizes of their current portfolio and with their planograms for each size, and they do plan on going forward with a wide variety of square footprints. You see some Dollar Generals even as high as 15, 16, 17,000 square feet, especially those in the marketplace format, where, as I mentioned, you see others 6, 7, 8,000 square feet. Really kind of the median one, the one that you see most often, the store footprint you see most often, is that 9,000 to 10,000 square foot addition. They say all of them can work well when executed properly on the planogram front.
They did discuss their continued push into Fresh Foods as well. Fresh and refrigerated foods was a big subject during the meeting, with management maintaining their desire to add cooler doors and expand that section in their stores. This is all part of their ongoing program called DG Fresh. So to make good on their DG Fresh goals, they've had to build out their distribution platform, of course, since their networks weren't really optimized for perishables. They made a note of the fact that they have 6,000 stores, or actually over 6,000 stores as of right now, that were served by their new DG Fresh distribution network and facilities by the end of 2019, with that number slated to increase even with the COVID-19 impacts in 2020. We expect some slowing down of their plans, but they are still growing that out as we speak. But by building out their own distribution platform versus being tied into deals with local vendors, it has allowed Dollar General to expand margins and lower customer-facing prices on a number of food products. They also feel as though that over time, doing this in-house will allow greater selection for customers while also ensuring out-of-stocks stay lower than what was previously experienced. And I think this is very smart on their end. Anytime you have the opportunity to control your supply chain and then also reap the benefits in terms of margins, it's going to be a win-win situation. And I think a lot of their customers, we have to think about the end result here, really do want more fresh foods within those stores, especially those stores that are in the rural parts of the United States. It's not only fresh food that they are concerned about, though, as we head into the next decade. Indeed, during Investor Day, we heard the treasure hunt term that is so often said during earnings calls on many off-price stores. They referenced their non-consumables initiative, which at this point has been launched to over 2,500 stores. The goal here is to seek improvement on both sales and margin while also providing that elusive treasure hunt experience that those customers may desire. This initiative, along with their build-out in food, has contributed to the fact that now a whopping 22% of products sold are priced at $1 or less. So it really speaks to maybe the eye they have on their competitor in Dollar Tree as well, noting that lower price point items are desired amongst the majority of their consumer base. And during the earnings call, we have some interesting comments from the lead executives there at Dollar General. Todd Vaso said that he felt like their unique brick and mortar footprint put them in a position for a good quarter already. And so, although people weren't leaving their house much, the convenience of a Dollar General in so many rural U.S. towns certainly attracted many people to come in and buy necessary products or essential products during this time frame. Something we haven't talked about much on the show yet is the relative attitude of those in rural areas. Many expressed a desire to avoid larger cities as the outbreak, or at least media coverage of the outbreak, centered around those larger municipalities. As such, it makes sense that they were staying in their local towns, those smaller cities, maybe surrounding a metropolitan area, to shop at a Dollar General, a Family Dollar, or maybe their local grocer to stock up on purchases, rather than going to a larger city to go to their Walmart or Target to get those items. Vasos also noted that this footprint would be crucial to their long-term growth, no doubt supporting their goals of unit growth over the next few years with this statement. One thing that Vasos also mentioned is, albeit a little bit later on in the call, is their strong relationship with suppliers. As of right now, Dollar General has a much stronger relationship than any other e-commerce pure play with the likes of P&G, Kraft, and so forth. This also allowed them to restock with relative ease during this time frame, while smaller retailers and Amazon were left weeks without some products. And I think, Trent, it really makes sense when you look at some of those Amazon shipping times over the past couple of months, maybe promising 3 to 4 weeks in some of the products that were not essential, when maybe you can just go to your local Dollar General and pick it up instantaneously.
And even with the essential products, obviously Amazon somewhat newer to the consumables space when you look at the whole scheme of things than Dollar General, but Dollar General's massive store footprint obviously giving them a leg up with a number of suppliers. And I want to go back to one thing that you said, because we talked about the attitude of those in rural areas, and you don't certainly want to generalize, but I was actually talking to someone that works for a school district in a rural area, and they were actually told, hey, if you go to one of the surrounding larger towns, you have to self-quarantine for 14 days. So there was actually a job-related reason for them not to go into those larger towns, an occupational reason, rather than just, hey, sentiment regarding the outbreak seeming to be larger in those bigger areas where there's more people milling about. Now, a couple of other things we wanted to talk about during the call. One is that I found this interesting because we've talked before about some of the data regarding whether it be grocery sales or supermarket sales or even other general merchandise retailers kind of seeing a bit of a tailing off of sales as we head into May. That was not the case for Dollar General. They did give us a little bit of insight as to their sales all the way up to May 26th from the end of the first quarter. So basically, we're looking at the lion's share of the month of May here. During that period of time, they said same-store sales had increased by approximately 22%. Now, they said that while also saying that, hey, you know, the timing of stimulus checks may have affected that. We might see sales maybe go to more normalized levels during the second half of the quarter as some of these shelter-in-place regulations begin to lift. But still, that's a larger same-store sales lift than we thought we were going to see from them in May alone, especially given the data from other retailers. And this is actually something that's consistent with some of the retailers that released earnings this week, saying, hey, you know, actually May sales look pretty good, a lot of it having to do with the timing of those stimulus checks. Few other things I wanted to mention. We talked about cooler doors earlier on in the show. During the first quarter alone, they installed more than 15,000 cooler doors across their store base. They expect to install 55,000 as a whole this year. So they're going to basically aim for kind of a record in sales associated with cold and frozen good items. One other initiative that they've got in the pipeline is building out their private brands. So they managed to reposition some of their private label brands, especially the what's called the True Living label, and this is for household goods, especially as it relates to laundry. They relaunched that brand in the first quarter. They've also redesigned Clover Valley products. Clover Valley has been a long time private label brand for them. That's now rolled out with about 250 items now available with the new branding. They're seeking to not only introduce more products with the refreshed branding, but also more products under that label as time goes on. And then a couple of other things they noted, just as general initiatives on the call. With that DG Fresh program, they have what's called a Better For You offering. Now, that's kind of another program that they're offering underneath the auspices of that DG Fresh program. And we're talking about those initiatives on the corporate level. So the DG Fresh might not be the branding that you'll see if you walk into a Dollar General, but you'll see Better For You. And they mentioned they feel like this is especially important given restaurant closures, given that more food is being consumed in the home. They've managed to expand that to about 6,000 stores. They want to expand that offering to about 7,000 stores by year end. And part of this, of course, you have to wonder about the PR aspect of it because, again, you think back to that CBS News story about how dollar stores might be a bad deal for America and how they sell largely unhealthy food. That's not always the case. And Dollar General has worked not just since that story, but over the last several years to bring better and fresher food to some of these smaller markets, especially as you see supermarkets begin to close down because of economic unviability in some of the smaller areas, although you might not have seen that as much over the last few months with a lot of people flooding to the supermarkets. And then a final thing, they talked about their FedEx relationship. So for those that don't know, they've managed to partner with FedEx to bring FedEx services to around 4,800 locations. They want that in 8,500 stores by year end, the ability to basically be able to provide FedEx services in those particular stores. While it is easy enough to just slap a FedEx service in a store, it does take some time as far as associate training to make sure that they are up on the FedEx processes and procedures. And that's what they're going through at this point right now. But they said, hey, with all of these locations in rural areas, it gives FedEx the opportunity to really reach out to areas that they haven't been able to serve previously. Well, that'll do it for our first story, a deep dive into Dollar General, again, with a couple of big events this week, that earnings call and their yearly meeting of shareholders. Coming up after this break, we're going to talk about Big Lots and how they surprised everyone, including us, in a positive way during earnings. We'll also talk about Tuesday morning filing for bankruptcy. This week's episode of the Retail Focus Podcast is brought to you by Easy Texting. They're the number one SMS marketing software. They've helped to date over 160,000 customers succeed with over 5 billion messages sent out on behalf of their customers. You know, Leighton, texting delivers far more engagement. Some numbers say around 600% more engagement than email because no one reads emails, but everyone reads their text messages. And that's why 89% of customers prefer messaging as their method to communicate with businesses.
Yeah, for both large and small businesses, you could do a number of things. You can facilitate scheduling, send your employees their schedule via text, which is often easy for the millennial generation or any younger generation that is always connected to their smartphone. You can expand your workforce by messaging a list of previous applicants that maybe you turned down, but now you have that opening. For retailers, you can let your most loyal shoppers know about the changes to your store that are coming up, maybe new store hours, new curbside pickup policies, and when certain items that they may have been looking at as essential restock, or maybe when new merchandise arrives, that new shoe or whatever entices your customer base. And also, lastly, Trent, you can provide an excellent customer service experience. Text your customers assembly instructions, ask them how they liked that product or service that you afforded to them, and get that immediate feedback to see maybe what you as a retailer need to change going forward.
And Easy Texting right now is offering a free trial to listeners of the Retail Focus Podcast. You can text RETAIL to 858585. Easy enough to remember. Again, text RETAIL to 858585. Message and data rates may apply for this recurring message program. Again, don't miss out. It's a free trial of Easy Texting just for our listeners. Text RETAIL to 858585. So as we teased before the break, a retailer that we haven't talked about a lot since the onset of the pandemic in Big Lots caught a number of onlookers by surprise with their earnings that came out this last week. We'll talk about the numbers a little bit, but there are some other facets that we found interesting from their earnings call, particularly which categories of sales were doing well and when for Big Lots. It gives us kind of an eye into the pandemic buying pattern of the U.S., over the last few months. Now, Big Lots' bottom line numbers were stellar. They had earnings of $1.26 per share versus Zacks' consensus expectations of 41 cents per share. This is perhaps suggestive of them finally attaining the position they fought for so long as kind of a neighborhood retailer who always carries certain items in stock versus the here today, gone tomorrow merchandise stocking of their past. And we'll talk about their merchandise mix later on in the story. But Big Lots, like others, may also see a long-term benefit coming out of the pandemic because they were able to capitalize on a number of first-time customers or maybe customers returning to them after a long absence. And along with possible recessionary buying habits, the company might be in a positive position over the next few years after a good 8 years of stagnation. In their position for growth tagline that they've had the past several years on their investor relations page, Leighton, that may finally be proving true.
Yeah, it may. And as we delve into the numbers, a lot of interesting things to unpack here. Their earnings for their fiscal first quarter were released on Friday, May 29th. Aside from the bottom line beat, which we already discussed, their numbers proved solid as well. Their overall comparable sales were up 10.3% over a year ago. They are always nice enough, too, to bring this down into e-commerce and store comps, so we have a better comparison of what's going on within store operations. But store comps were the big story here, up 10%, which is perhaps better than where we would have placed them. For the record, we saw them coming in around Dollar Tree's enterprise same-store sales increase of around 7%, so they beat our expectations. But their e-commerce direct sales, so sales not routed through brick-and-mortar locations, were up 45%, so they're killing it on both sides of the business. Although this is a good number for them, it suggests a lot of room for growth in that category, as most retailers were above 50%, especially those more immature with their e-commerce platform, like, let's say, Big Lots, for example. As a bit of a background. On their e-commerce platform, it was just launched in 2016, and its relative youth means they still cannot accept Big Lots credit or gift cards through the platform, which speaks to the definite room for growth here. They did note that they saw growth in buy online, pickup in store during the quarter, which would be reflected in that in-store number. Even still, taken as a whole, their overall revenue was still up 11.1%, which is pretty good for a company that not that long ago people were wondering if it was going to be around in the next few years. Most of this was due to comps, that 11.1% at least, but a good portion was attributable to their relocated stores not included in comps and a few openings over the past year. They opened 2 new stores in the quarter, by the way, to bring their total up to 1,404 stores in 47 states. Bruce Thorne, their CEO, indicated on the call that they've seen sales momentum continue into the early part of the second quarter as well. Their earnings per diluted share was reflective of a sizable increase of 34 cents from last year's adjusted earnings per share. As with Dollar General, as we just spoke about, they saw outsized profit growth compared to other retailers, likely as a result of a limited increase in cost versus grocers and other retailers out there doing business. This after increasing employee pay by $2 per hour for all store and distribution center associates. So a nice bump there for their employees, a nice note of respect for those on the front lines of retail, if you will. Also, they did see store cleaning expenditures rise, and we expected this, along with the spending on things like plexiglass shields at the point of sale areas. So if you look here, Trent, a lot of things, like I said, to unpack, but really Big Lots has turned the corner here. They've been proactive on a number of fronts, and although they stated that they would not reintroduce guidance for the full fiscal year, this was withdrawn back on March 30th, they did provide a provisional number for the second quarter. They said that so far in the quarter, sales remain up early in the second quarter. I think that's a really good thing, Trent. If you're looking at these comps and then seeing maybe what they have in store for the rest of the year, you should be fairly optimistic.
This goes along with what we were talking about with Dollar General. So far early in Q2, so basically May to this point, they have seen comps be pretty solid. And they noted on the call, assuming their comps come in where they did in the first quarter, Big Lots sees diluted earnings per share coming in around 65 cents to 80 cents per share. That also factors in COVID-19 related expenses of $18 million. But here's the kicker. They said, assuming comps come in where they did in Q1, and again, a number of retailers that saw a COVID bump are saying that sales are slowing down somewhat comparatively, but that doesn't seem to be the case here because Big Lots said that projecting comps in Q2 to come in even sequentially with Q1 would actually be a conservative model, meaning that their comps so far in Q2 are actually higher than they were in Q1. So something to chew on there. Things looking very good in May for Big Lots and very good so far in Q2. Now, during the call, CEO Bruce Thorne said that in February, things weren't looking so great from a sales perspective. And this is where we get kind of a window into not only Big Lots sales, but also how people might be spending money. Now, Dollar General said their same-store sales were up 5.5% in February. That was not the case for Big Lots because promotional activity in January of this year pulled some business away from February, is what at least leadership believed. Additionally, what they called choppiness in income tax refunds during February hindered their furniture sales during that month. Then the roller coaster tilted upward with the first slate of panic buying in March. Sales at Big Lots ticked up, especially in consumables. Then the roller coaster shifted back down towards the bottom in early April for a couple of reasons. One is they were lapping their friends and family event from last April, which is always a sales driver for them, but it was not held this year because of the pandemic. That makes sense. Two, they actually made the decision to close on Easter this year. So that was a day of sales, albeit usually Easter sales are somewhat muted at most retailers. But they decided to close to give their employees a bit of a break, and that caused a slight downturn in comps in early April. But then that roller coaster worked its way back up to the top as people began receiving their stimulus checks. Something we've heard from several retailers actually is that they saw maybe a bit of a bump in late April as those stimulus checks or stimulus ACH payments, if you will, started to filter in. And that push later in the quarter driven by the stimulus checks also had an impact on the margin front. High-selling categories shifted over to furniture and seasonal as customers sought to augment their homes. And this calls back to something referenced by Doug McMillon in Walmart's earnings call, that people staying at home were beginning to find needs in their home experiences. They were finding holes, maybe, that could be patched up as far as their at-home experiences, and they spent some of their stimulus checks on improving that at-home experience. And given the cadence of this and looking beyond Big Lots, you wonder if this will have a net negative effect on retailers like At Home, because people were seeing these holes, maybe. They were getting their stimulus checks, but At Home was only able to begin reopening stores really in May, whereas Big Lots was open the entire time as people started seeing those stimulus checks hit. In any case, the shifts that Big Lots saw towards furniture and seasonal towards the end of the quarter helped them big time on the margin front, because pandemic buying conditions in March and early April were centered around food and consumables, and for Big Lots, as for most retailers, those categories are low margin. As a result, the late quarter push saw Big Lots salvage gross margin somewhat, although it still ended down 80 basis points from last year. Still not as bad as what we've seen from other retailers who saw that pandemic buying bump.
Something we've been watching over the past few weeks is the presence of deals for off-price stores. Although Big Lots is now more of a hybrid store model than a pure off-price store, closeout availability did come up on the call. Back several years ago, 50% of their sales were from closeouts. Now, just 9 to 10% of their sales are from the closeout category. Thorne said they are excited about the ability to lean into closeouts to continue to differentiate their assortment compared to other neighborhood retailers. Think maybe Dollar General and Family Dollar. The fact that their customer base has grown over the past few months, this was confirmed by management, by the way, means that more people have been exposed to their hybrid model and the ability to purchase special one-off deals. Partially as a result of this, and partially as a result of pre-existing plans, they have sought to differentiate the closeouts from the everyday items through the use of signage. This, in theory, makes it easier for Big Lots legacy shoppers to find the closeouts while also notifying new customers that these products may not be permanent and that they exist in the first place. They said that their buyers are seeing massive reductions in availability of closeouts in food because of pandemic buying. However, there has been a shift towards furniture, home goods, and apparel. Apparel has not always been a big category for them, but they noted that their buyers secured a large deal for girls' tops and shorts, which will fully be in stores by June. Lisa Bachman on the call said that they feel as though they have the permission from the customer to expand in apparel in certain areas, and they are seeing unprecedented deals right now in terms of the deal flow that their buyers, their supply chain buyers, are seeing at their end. So if they're seeing these deals, no doubt the standard off-pricers in apparel are seeing them as well. The availability of closeouts has shifted completely from pre-pandemic, where Big Lots has been somewhat frustrated at the lack of deals available in furniture, seasonal, and home, but deals in food were plentiful. Their ability to secure closeouts has improved with the massive positive cash flow from this latest quarter and should improve further as they complete an ongoing sale leaseback for several of their distribution centers. And those are going to be allowing them to leverage a lot of future capital, because distribution centers are obviously going to secure more funds than, say, a standalone retail center. So even before the pandemic, Big Lots was in the middle of plans for a front-end reconfiguration that we had actually talked about several times on this podcast, and they were really trying to attempt to open up more space as part of the store of the future that we've discussed. And they expect over half of their locations to have renovated front ends by the holiday season. The newly opened space there at the front end, they plan on using to highlight one-time buys resulting from said closeout purchases, maybe, but also merchandise from a relatively new partner, one they discussed a lot on the call. And that partner is Broyhill. And Broyhill, if you're thinking furniture, you are correct, in part because of the pre-existing brand strength, and in part because of the stimulus checks. They are seeing major sales growth in each category Broyhill touches. This isn't limited to hard furniture either. It has stretched out to outdoor furniture, accent items, windows coverings, and bedding. And so you're seeing a lot of different categories that this partnership is going to really help them with and help in terms of that brand strength. I think that really speaks to how Big Lots views this opportunity going forward, in that furniture has always been in their stores, or has been over the past many years. And I think this is really going to make it easier for customers to associate furniture with Big Lots. In fact, Big Lots wasn't even able to fully launch their marketing for this Broyhill product line before many of the first wave of products actually sold through Big Lots. Not only does this bode well for Big Lots, but this is a major win for Broyhill, whose other retail partners were largely shut down during the pandemic.
So one interesting ongoing initiative they had in the pipeline pre-pandemic, other than Broyhill, will still be in the company's plans, which we found odd. And this initiative is to move square footage away from food staples and towards what they call food, entertainment, and consumables. Now, we found this odd because food staples kept their sales afloat in March and early April, but also because their new customers now count on those categories. All those new customers that they're talking about are the returning customers during the pandemic came to rely on Big Lots for those recurring staple categories. However, Big Lots still wants to shift away from these categories because it gives them, and I quote, higher permission to play, basically allowing their merchandisers and buyers flexibility to work with that particular section that they're taking away from food staples to produce higher margin results. Now, this won't mean that they're going completely away from food staples. It's just that they're taking some of that square footage away from it to give that flexibility back to merchandisers and buyers to work on increasing their margins. And they want there also to be higher variability to encourage more frequent trips. Again, it comes back to that treasure hunt mentality that we hear time and time again. But it's important now for Big Lots to strike a balance, because staples were not a key category for them pre-pandemic. And in fact, they had mentioned on previous earnings calls that the momentum they thought they were going to see in staples just didn't happen. But now this pandemic has served as a catalyst to bring people in for those staples. A number of new shoppers have now come to depend on Big Lots for these products, and they have to find a way to continue delivering on this front while continuing to play a little bit, to use their terms, in that food entertainment category to provide that treasure hunt goal they aim for. But again, going back to something Leighton mentioned, only 9 to 10% of their sales now are in the closeout category. So again, Big Lots much more of a, hey, we're going to stock this and we're going to stock this on a permanent basis retailer than an off-price or a closeout retailer in terms of their merchandising mix. So it's about towing that very, very fine line. And I'm anxious to see how Big Lots approaches that towards the end of the year when they're slated to make that change. And we close the podcast on a less than positive note as Off-Pricer Tuesday Morning files for bankruptcy this week. The bankruptcy announcement comes alongside their plans to close around 230 stores in the very near future, likely by the end of summer. Now, unlike Big Lots, Tuesday Morning was an off-price store that didn't really have a leg to stand on in terms of keeping locations open. With Big Lots, obviously, you have such a large selection of consumables. Tuesday Morning, that really wasn't the case. Now, the closures over the last few months likely sealed the bankruptcy fate of the retailer, who, like JCPenney, has seen a number of false starts as it has attempted to achieve profitability over the last 5 to 7 years. Also, like JCPenney, Tuesday Morning had a recent unexpected leadership shakeup, which no doubt kind of hindered matters as well. Their newer CEO, he's not brand new, Steve Becker, he's had a bit of time to begin the turnaround under his regime, but not nearly enough time to get Tuesday Morning in the proper position to be resistant to 2 months worth of closed stores. They closed all of their stores across the board on March 25th. Some stores had closed prior to that point. Now, March 25th is a wholesale closure. That was a bit later than some retailers in the non-essential category, but still basically assured the company of no revenue for the foreseeable future because no e-commerce presence. At the time, they had announced that they had drawn $55 million from their revolving credit facility to get through the pandemic, adding to their already existing $91 million on that credit facility. Now, looking back, might have been enough to get them through April, but the ability to reopen locations came too slowly to save them from severe liquidity issues, even with so many of their locations. You look in states like Texas, for example, that were a little bit more bullish about reopening these retailers. Now, Becker said in a prepared statement that Chapter 11 had become the only option for the retailer in light of the lack of revenue. And as I mentioned before, they have no e-commerce revenue to lean back on. The company has long said, just like Ross, for example, that the mechanics of selling via e-commerce carry far more negatives than positives with their off-price stance. So no revenue coming in because all their stores were closed makes complete sense that a retailer who wasn't doing all that well on the balance sheet before the pandemic would declare Chapter 11.
We should be mindful of the fact that Tuesday morning had 687 stores coming into the announcement. So by no means are most of their stores closing. Still, the 230 planned closures are a point of realignment of their store and distribution footprint. I put quotations around that. And it's reflective of a large number of their overall brick and mortar footprint. The company noted in a prepared statement that 132 stores have already been identified as stores that will be closing over the summer. The other 98 will be identified after negotiations with landlords to attempt to find some middle ground with current leases. And I think that's really smart to leverage the current circumstances too, because landlords are trying to keep most of their shopping centers fully occupied going forward. Tuesday morning's typical footprint in outdoor strip centers might be a detriment to their efforts to renegotiate leases with certain landlords. However, it is common to find them in grocery-anchored neighborhood shopping centers or alongside other off-pricers. To this end, there are a number of retailers who, pre-pandemic, have been seeking those exact spots. So it could be an opportunity for them to come in, and if the landlord then knows that, they could say bye to Tuesday morning. As we've discussed recently, grocery-anchored neighborhood centers are seeing far more tenants pay rent than other retail locations. This doesn't necessarily mean that people will be lining up to take over Tuesday morning space, but it at least means that landlords won't have their backs against the wall in the same way that mall landlords, for instance, may right now. Landlords with Tuesday morning locations in their portfolio have no doubt been sending feelers out for more stable retailers for some time. In any case, we should also mention that once these stores are closed, their distribution center in Phoenix is also planned to close. So we see from this that the Southwestern U.S. must have been one of the more underperforming regions for them. As an aside, distribution centers in that part of the country can be pricey to operate, especially if you have HVAC. And our research indicates that they actually have swamp coolers in place to provide cool airflow, meaning higher electric costs in those areas of the country. The Phoenix Distribution Center was just opened in 2015 with about 500 employees. However, problems were apparent in 2018 when they began cutting back hours for some employees during the slower seasonal periods. By now, around 80% of their stores have reopened, in theory allowing potential liquidations to begin relatively quickly at those affected stores. One interesting note is that Tuesday morning has seen sales increases on a year-over-year basis after opening locations. So some locations were able to reopen as soon as April 24th, and so some have been doing better than expectations and some have not. Maybe those locations that were already underperforming have continued to underperform those that have reopened. This is a valuable data point in what will be a huge question as people begin to get back and shop at some stores. The question has been asked, will sales slowly ramp up or will stores be flooded by people desperate to get back to normal with long shopping lists that they've been making over the past 2 or 3 months? In Tuesday morning's case, same-store sales at recently opened stores have improved by around 10%, a massive number for Tuesday morning. Now, it bears noting that their merchandise mix and position as an off-price retailer might be helping them out in this regard versus a run-of-the-mill apparel retailer. While you might call Tuesday morning many things, maybe inefficient, in need of consistent branding, etc., they are not undifferentiated. Their value proposition, especially for home goods and kitchen gadgets, might be drawing people in who are tired of waiting 3 weeks for maybe their potato masher they ordered on Amazon to finally arrive. And as we know, people are cooking more in home, a lot more than pre-pandemic, and restaurant openings are sure to be slow and restricted. And so in many parts of the country, some are open now, but maybe several months in other parts of the country where you see full-service restaurants back in operation. But Tuesday morning, TJ Maxx, and Burlington all figure to potentially be factors in this particular space over the next few months as people try to bargain hunt for those in-home accessories. Aspects of their bankruptcy filing not related to store closures include their ability to secure some debtor-in-possession financing, Trent, worth $100 million, and this is designed to support their operations in the short term as they navigate the bankruptcy process.
And that is contingent on Tuesday morning finding an additional $25 million in other financing, which they said that they're in the works on currently. They didn't express any potential negatives surrounding the ability to capture that additional $25 million in financing. Now, it's worth noting that rumors have been very few regarding the bankruptcy. Granted, Tuesday morning isn't as high profile as JCPenney. They're not necessarily what you would consider a legacy retailer, at least in the same vein, but comments by leadership appear to indicate that the process may be somewhat straightforward. You're looking at, obviously, the renegotiations of leases and the like, but we've seen surprises in bankruptcy before. I think the last retail bankruptcy that we were really surprised at the company not being able to find a way out was Shopko. They said, hey, at first we're going to close X amount of stores and we're going to keep the rest of the stores open, but then there were hiccups along the line and all Shopko stores closed. It's kind of funny, though, because you look back and had a lot of those Shopko stores remained open through this pandemic. You wonder how the pandemic and pandemic buying practices might have actually kept Shopko afloat if they could have just held out one more year. But still, we've seen surprises in bankruptcy, but the company is indicating they expect this to be a fairly straightforward process and come through the process a leaner, meaner Tuesday morning.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
We've reached the final segment of the Retail Focus podcast, where each Leighton and I take a look ahead at one story we're keeping an eye on over the next week, month, or year. And this week, we'll begin with me. I am looking ahead to pet retail and a great article at petbusiness.com by the Pet Business Magazine. Sean Simpson was the writer of this article, showing some light on the dynamics of pet sales during the pandemic. We talked about Big Lots really riding the roller coaster of sales during pandemic conditions in March and April. Pet supplies and pet products saw a similar roller coaster, but maybe a steeper one, because second and third week of March, 40% growth for pet food, 51% growth in pet supplies year over year. Nielsen data showing that in-store retail sales up 26% during that time. E-commerce channels up 77% at that time. So helping Chewy.com and others out there. But as was noted in this particular article by Sean Simpson, pet food is a fixed consumption category. You know, it's not like pets were going out to restaurants like humans were and now having to replace that with cooking. Pets were almost always eating at home. And so we see a trend towards people stocking up on pet food and then not needing pet food. As a result, dollar sales of pet products dropped 40% from the third week of March to the fourth week of March, which is still about 15% below previous year's levels. So we saw sales actually spike at the beginning of March and then decrease to below last year's levels at the end of March when people realized, well, hey, we don't have to shop anymore for the pets because it's not like the pets are eating any more food at home than they were to begin with. But there were some interesting other data points. For example, we saw an increase in treat sales in March of 28%. Treats continued to be up slightly in April. In fact, while the rest of the pet industry is down and dry food down 15%, wet food down 1%. Treats have actually gone up and treat sales have gone up in April by 9%. Now, could be a number of reasons for this. People staying home, people training their pets, what have you, or people's being home and actually allowing the pets to snack a little bit during the day, where if people had been at work, that wouldn't necessarily be the case. But the reason this is my looking ahead story is this. we know that pet ownership actually went up as a result of the pandemic. There were a lot of humane societies saying, hey, we're out of dogs, in fact, for the first time ever. And there was an increase in sales of pet bedding and accessories in late April. So what is the new frontier of pet buying going to look like? Ultimately, you have to figure with pet ownership going up, more people are going to be spending money on those pets than ever. At the same time, you have the recessionary buying habits that everyone seems to be concerned with. So will you see product substitutions? Will you see people buying gadgets for their pets the same way you did pre-pandemic? There's a lot to be determined. Eventually, food sales will kind of normalize, you figure, as we get into summer. But I'll be keeping a careful eye on this category because ultimately the pandemic could result in a net positive for the retail sales of pet products, but it may completely change the way in which pet products are bought because of the substitution of some of those high-priced goods.
Well, I guess it's my time for my looking ahead story for this week, Trent. I have a pretty strong story, and it actually ties into something we've talked about over the past few months with the changing grocery landscape on the southeasternmost part of the United States, where you have Southeastern Grocers, who owns a number of brands. Southeastern owns Buy Low, Winn-Dixie, Harvey Supermarket, and Fresco y Mas in a number of states. So everywhere pretty much in the Southeast, Alabama, Florida, Georgia, Louisiana, Mississippi, North Carolina, and of course, South Carolina. Well, recently, with the announcement of the Lucky's Market and Earth Fair bankruptcies, you have a number of leases that were up for sale, a number of buildings that were potentially up for sale or for lease now, with them exiting the market there in certain areas. So Southeastern Grocers, with their Winn-Dixie banner, came in and ended up purchasing several leases in the Florida market. Jacksonville, Florida is actually where they're based, so they know these particular markets fairly well, where Lucky's Market and Earth Fair were doing business. They purchased the leases. According to some, they purchased four leases from Lucky's Market for around $2.4 million. And then for an undisclosed amount, they bought a couple more leases from Earth Fair in mid-April. So we don't know the specifics on that, but what we do know is that from a statement from Southeastern Grocers, they said that they know those markets fairly well and they're committed to serving those immediate markets. And I quote, "We are committed to supporting enriching and growing communities where we serve. Winn-Dixie is deeply rooted in Florida, and we are proud to expand our footprint and enhance our presence throughout the state." And that was from their CEO, Anthony Hucker. I think, Trent, this is really interesting because they obviously see a value proposition here. Lucky's Market did sell a lot of natural and organic selection, but they just weren't profitable. And I think it was interesting because they had a lot of customers coming in and they chose really, really good locations to do business in, but it just didn't work out. They were sort of an up-and-coming grocer, and Southeastern has a lot more capital than they did, so they can take a bigger bet on this. What I find interesting, though, and I think this is something that really ties into the idea of this being a looking ahead story, is Southeastern Grocers actually purchased leases. So they not only have that upfront cost of buying the lease, but they also have to pay the lease throughout. So they're actually paying a premium on what Lucky's was already paying, essentially, by taking ownership or the rights of that lease. So one thing that pops in my mind is maybe the lease rates were fairly low to begin with, and that they've already identified those locations as potential growth opportunities maybe previously when canvassing that particular area in Florida or these several different areas in Florida. So you're looking at areas in Fort Myers, Gainesville, Lake Mary, and Melbourne. And I think it's fairly interesting because they must have confidence in growing those particular areas, or at least they look at the demographic and see that there is still a need for a local grocer. But overall, Trent, you're looking at not these huge footprints, so it's still going to be manageable, one would think, for Southeastern Grocers. Nothing too much in terms of overhead and just normal operating the building month to month. But I am very excited because this means that these are going to be areas that are not going to turn into grocery deserts, and this is going to be an opportunity to Southeastern Grocers Point for those local communities to then have a grocer still on that corner or maybe in that regional strip center where they do business. And I think that's extremely important, again, for the company, but then also speaks to the areas in which, you know, a company may go bankrupt in the grocery space, but there's always going to be another company, another grocer that sees that as an opportunity. I really think that speaks to the staying power of brick and mortar grocery going forward.
And you mentioned the staying power. You know, Southeastern Grocers is a company we were talking about a few years ago on the podcast is shrinking their footprint and closing certain stores. And so this is not necessarily a reversal, of course, but an opportunity for them to jump into a even more of a crowded grocery market in the Southeastern United States, which I think is the Southeast and Northeast United States, both very, very crowded in terms of players in the grocery market. But it makes certainly for interesting onlooking and interesting conversation when you talk about retail grocery. Well, that'll do it for us here on the podcast. A big thanks to everyone who listens week in, week out. We'll be back joined by hopefully Danny Cushion of Cardlytics, going to discuss some new data from Cardlytics surrounding the current state of the consumer. We also want to thank our sponsor for this week's show. Once again, you can check them out. Easy texting. Text RETAIL to 858585 for a free trial. We'll be back with you 1 week from now.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.